If you knew that your screw up, there was a guy wasting away in an El Salvadorian prison because you made a mistake. I don't know how somebody sleeps at night knowing that.
I would feel bad.
Yeah, I would feel bad.
I would feel bad. And this is the kind of degeneracy that having a sociopathic, authoritarian, fascist leader creates in a society.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain all the illegal news to me. What's up, George?
Well, there's more illegal news every week.
The thing I'm most eager to talk to you about is Trump signing these executive orders yesterday to have Miles Taylor and Chris Krebs investigated. But I'm going to save that for the end because there's a lot of other legal news that has happened since we last spoke. And right. I want to dig into that first. And the first is, so the Alien Enemies Act. Okay, so we finally have a few preliminary decisions from the Supreme Court. And I want to talk about first the Trump v. JGG. So in a 5-4 decision this week with all the female justices dissenting, so that includes Amy Coney Barrett, the court held that while individuals detained and facing removal under the Alien Enemy Act are entitled to due process, they have to bring a habeas petition rather than proceed under the Administrative Procedure Act. I don't think we need to get into the weeds on this, but broadly speaking, this is a narrow procedural holding, and the court said folks contesting their removal from the country under the Alien Enemies Act need to do so via the correct procedural vehicle. So if you had to read some tea leaves here, what did we learn about the Supreme Court's posture toward the administration? Right, because the reason I want to talk about this first is like we're just starting to get some feedback from the Supreme Court about how they're going to handle these things. And Trump's painting it like they're big wins, but they're really on these narrow procedural grounds. So explain this to us, please.
Well, I mean, this case is a bit of a kaleidoscope in terms of the ruling and whether or not it's good or bad. And I think the best way to characterize it for the moment is a mixed bag. Some people see it a harbinger one way or the other. I think it's just too early to say. And it is a highly technical, weedy, you know, get into the weeds issue of whether or not you have to bring suit under the Administrative Procedure Act, which is the way you challenge almost any agency decision, including those of ICE. And then habeas corpus, which is what basically the traditional writ that's existed for centuries by which you challenge an unlawful detention. And there are lots of arguments both ways as to whether or not these cases are properly sound in habeas. It's not clear to me that the court was right, not clear to me that the court was wrong. I mean, one argument that it was wrong is that these people were actually not necessarily challenging their detentions because they were already detained. What they were challenging was their deportation, and normally the way you challenge a deportation is under the Administrative Procedure Act. But that being said, the thing that the court said that was most unhelpful to the administration, which got a lot, not as much play as it probably should have, was that every single member of the court agreed that these individuals, before being whisked out of the country, were entitled to the due process of law under the Fifth Amendment. And that's very important. In fact, the majority opinion said that these individuals, before they are whisked out of the country by whatever means, are entitled to notice that they're about to be whisked out of the country so they could bring a proper case under the procedures of the habeas laws. So that is actually a rebuke to the Trump administration, and in particular to Stephen Miller, the non-lawyer, non-lawyer goon, who basically tweeted the other day that, you know, these people are entitled to no process at all, which is just not true. And actually, it was conceded by the government that they are entitled to process. And it was, you know, that basically, as the case came to the Supreme Court, notwithstanding that the government gave these people absolutely no due process, they, in fact, notwithstanding the Alien Enemies Act requires the president to issue a public proclamation, they did this in the middle of the night before they issued the proclamation. And they whisked these people out without a hearing. That being said, the government actually conceded, because it had to in the Supreme Court, that, you know, the Fifth Amendment applies and that these people are entitled to due process, and all members of the court agree on that. Now, the question is how you bring the case. If you bring it as a habeas case, it means you probably have to bring it in a different district, maybe, in some cases, because you have to bring a habeas case in the district, the federal district in which the unlawful detention is occurring. And that may be, for example, in Louisiana or Texas, but there's also a rule that if the person is being unlawfully detained outside the United States, there's some case law that says that the proper venue is the District of Columbia. So that's one problem that potential habeas petitioners and challengers now face, is they have to bring it in different districts, and some of these districts may not be as favorable as others. Although I think there was a case in Texas just yesterday where a court granted some temporary relief. And then the ACLU also brought a case in the Southern District of New York because there are some individuals being held there who are potentially subject to deportation. And they, interestingly, brought that habeas petition as a class action. It's not clear, you know, how that's going to work, because everybody's circumstances are different and class actions require a commonality of issues. And there is a commonality of issue here in that, are there enemies at all? Are these people enemies at all? Because we're not at war with anybody. Did anybody invade anybody? Are these people invading us? Well, I don't think there's an invasion within any meaning of the word. So, but, you know, these cases are going to proceed on a different timeline. And I think at the end of the day, most of these issues are going to get resolved one way or the other.
Well, this is, I guess, let me try to put it back to you in layman's terms, which is there are substantive questions about the law that are at the heart of these cases.
Correct.
But we're not even talking about those things yet. Right.
No.
Like, none of the cases are at the point where the things that they're considering or the rulings that are coming down actually address that point. Like, can you use the Alien Enemy Act?
Are the prerequisites met? The prerequisite being that there, you know, that there's a war or an invasion. I mean, is the fact that there are gang members in the United States who came here at various points in time, is that an invasion with the meaning of the statute? I can't imagine. So it's not an invasion. It may be other things, but it's not an invasion, and it's not a war. Certainly not a declared war.
And so these, and I think this is where you might find people to be confused, right? So you talk about Goon Stephen Miller, right? He's out there banging huge win for the administration, whatever. But there is no ruling on the substance of these. Like, we're not even there.
No.
It's all procedural, and it's all about these technicalities of how the cases were brought. And so the Supreme Court in no way is deciding on behalf of the administration. Now, although I do wonder, they're basically the TROs, right? There's temporary restraining orders that have been put in place on all these federal judges. It does seem like the Supreme Court is saying, well, we're going to let these proceed while we get to the substance of the cases, right?
Yeah.
So does that belie any, you know, just underlying support for the administration?
You know, I mean, I don't think it necessarily does. I do think the Supreme Court is intervening more than it probably should, because what happens when it intervenes at these stages is that they make these pronouncements that may not be accurate, because the record isn't fully developed yet. And one of the things that the Supreme Court historically in our lifetimes has done is it has tried to defer deciding things until all the issues have been properly sifted out at the district court level and the court of appeals level. I mean, the issues have a way of crystallizing where you figure out, okay, these five issues that mattered and lawyers spent weeks on in the district court aren't really the ones that matter. There's one issue that comes up and that matters that everybody's disagreeing on, and that's the one that the Supreme Court should decide. And that really is the function, the modern function of the Supreme Court. And every time they get involved in one of these, what Steve Bladick, my friend, calls shadow docket cases, they run the risk of creating more confusion. So, that's a legitimate concern. Although, it does give the administration a chance to characterize things, but, there's a technical term for what this administration does when events happen. And that's lie. I mean, they lie about whether this was a good decision, even though it directly contradicted. Yes, I understand that term. It's a common term. They lie about the fact that this wasn't helpful to the administration and that these people are entitled to the very due process that Steve Miller says that they are not entitled to. And he tried to deny them, and it's just like people saying, oh, what a genius move the president did yesterday by calling off the tariffs that he implemented and insisted he would not call off hours before. It was a genius move. They say anything. So
just as a side note on the tariffs thing, because we're not really going to get into the tariffs.
No,
stuff
we're not going to get into that.
But like,
but it's another example of lying.
It is an example of lying, but also, so obviously I think Trump is, the worst president of our lifetime, a bad human being. I do just get a chuckle sometimes, though, when he forces all of his minions to go out and like die on the idea that like, no, we are not bending on tariffs. They are good. We are going to reshore American manufacturing. And Trump is a genius. And then Trump
until 3 o'clock the next afternoon.
Trump pulls the rug out from under them, and then they all have to run and be like, "Oh no! Now Trump's a genius because he paused the tariffs and look at the market."
Paused the tariff, right? Yes.
These dummies. Anyway,
and then they're going to say he's a genius tomorrow when he puts them back on again.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so you bring up this point though, the way that the administration runs out and sort of says that it's getting handed a win in these procedural cases, right? And the way it's like positioning it publicly. And so there was this other interesting, it's another one of these narrow procedural decisions that came down last week. It's in a case called the Department of Education versus Louisiana. And so this was also a 5-4 decision, except this time it was Chief Justice Roberts allying himself with Justices Kagan, Jackson, and Sotomayor in the dissent. But the majority voted to stay a Massachusetts district court ruling that had ordered the federal government to continue to pay out approximately $65 million in teacher training grants that the Trump administration had claimed the authority to cut off. So this is one of those DOGE things, right? They cut this off. Court said, no, you got to keep paying this out. So it was being paid out. Supreme Court now says, nope, it can be cut off. But there was a footnote in Justice Jackson's dissent that was very interesting, because normally, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, when justices write these things, they don't take in the political context. They try to like be absolutely outside of any political context and just keep things strictly right. Legal. But in her footnote, she wrote, other than paving the way for the plaintiff state's immediate suffering, it appears that the primary effect of today's emergency stay is to hand the government an early win, a notch in its belt at the start of a legal battle in which the long-term prospects for its eventual success seem doubtful. And I don't blame the government for trying. If you're likely to lose on the merits, why not use the court's procedures to fight on new and creative fronts? The government has now gotten this court to nullify clearly warranted interim injunctive relief, deflecting attention away from the government's own highly questionable behavior, all without any showing of urgency or need. Well, that's interesting. She's basically saying our court's just trying to give them not a substantive win, but like a procedural one for show that also ignores, like, it was like the court is acting as though there's no urgency about the law breaking that is occurring? Like, did you find this to be interesting or illustrative in some way?
I found it to be very, very unusual. And it's just not, you know, it is not, I mean, they do it sometimes, but it's not often that the courts are talking about, explicitly talking about basically the PR and political effects of their rulings. And in the context of these expedited rulings, a lot is being read into them that doesn't necessarily tell us where the ultimate result of the case is going to land. And I think that is the point that Justice Jackson was making there. But it's really, really surprising to see her put it in those terms. And it's kind of disappointing that there's a member of the court who feels that the other members of the court are either doing that intentionally or acting in a manner that creates these misimpressions. I mean, I think one of the things that needs to happen with this court at some point is that they have to kind of stand back. And unless a district court ruling is absolutely off the wall, let it ride. And that really has been how the court has handled emergency applications most of the time during most of my career and most of our lifetimes, basically. It's really hard to get expedited relief this early in cases. I mean, the expedited relief that you get is when something just completely irreparable is going to happen in a case that presents issues of potential importance that the Supreme Court ultimately will have to resolve. And it's just not clear that these cases meet that traditional standard. I mean, it's one, and it's not a circumstance. What, you know, the death penalty cases, those are different because there's absolute irreparable harm. You can't fix it if somebody's executed. But for some of these cases, it's just not clear that the government is suffering irreparable harm here. So they have to pay out a grant that they've already paid out. It's just money. It's just a drop in the bucket. And the case is going to be expedited and there'll be more litigation to clarify the issues. And really on the merits, as Justice Jackson points out, seems like they have a case. And it may be that they would not have issued these injunctions, these early TROs or injunctions, and ordinarily TROs aren't appealable. But the court shouldn't be taking its time with a lot of this stuff at this point. It should wait for these issues to come up fully briefed and fully matured. So they can really focus on the most important issues of the case, which they're not doing right now.
Yeah.
Awesome.
All right. Before we get to Miles and Chris, I want to ask you about just another thing that is one of these incredibly troubling things going on in the administration.
Right.
And by that, I mean the DOJ. So in the case of Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia, a senior DOJ attorney admitted in court Abrego Garcia had been accidentally sent to a high security prison in El Salvador due to an administrative error. DOJ then put that government lawyer on leave, okay, for failing to zealously advocate for the United States, meaning Pam Bondi and the Department of Justice are disciplining their own lawyers for telling the truth in court, which they have a professional and ethical obligation to do. So if that truth is contrary to the administration's position, they still have to tell the truth. Like, that's their obligation. Is this have you ever seen anything like this?
No. And I mean, it's really a remarkable case for a number of reasons. The first is that the government concedes, right? This lawyer had to go into court. And he's a long-standing, experienced government lawyer to go into court and basically defend something that the government conceded was wrong because they had no basis to remove this guy, and they 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 don't contend otherwise. Their position really is, without evidence, that they can't get him back because he's now in this El Salvador detention facility, this guy who basically was never convicted of a crime. There's no evidence that he's a member of a gang. All right. The evidence that had been previously cited by the government years ago was that he was wearing a Chicago Bulls cap or something like that. He's a well-known group of terrorists from the 90s.
He
lived in Beltsville, Maryland, peacefully for years. He has an American citizen wife, and he has an American citizen special needs kids. And they basically carted him off, sent him away without making any determination, a legitimate determination that he was a member of, which was what the basis was originally, was a member of MS-13. And now the government says, sorry, we can't get him back. So I don't know. You're going into court. It's hard to be, I mean, it's zealous just to be able to stand up there and take the abuse that a judge is going to give you, taking a ridiculous position that the government is making you take, which is that we have no help. We have no way of helping, even though we are paying the government of El Salvador millions of dollars to hold people for us. Somehow we have the power to make them take people, even if they're not legally in custody or legally deportable, yet somehow we can't even ask the government of El Salvador to say, sorry, this one we shouldn't have sent you, so could you send him back? We'll send a plane. And I mean, I don't know exactly what it was that this fellow said. I'd like to go see the transcript that they objected to. But, you know, I think probably that he was just embarrassed to be there. And I can't blame him for being embarrassed to be there. He made some concessions before the court that they didn't like. But sometimes, you know, you have to do that to maintain your credibility for the court. And as you point out, to live up to your obligations as an officer of the court and a member of the bar. So it's really, really appalling. It sends a terrible message to people in the Justice Department. I think it's going to encourage more good, decent lawyers to leave the Justice Department because they see themselves as being forced to engage in unethical or questionable activities and making representations before judges or making statements before judges that they can't really justify.
Can I ask you a question that's like not really a fair question that I don't know why you would know the answer to, but why can't we just get this guy back? Like, it's so strange to me. This is where the United States government, you would think they would just be like, they've already said like we did an oopsie and it's a bad oopsie. Why wouldn't they go get this guy and bring him back? What's the problem?
Well, because then there'd be, I mean, there are a couple of reasons, I think. One is it'd be politically embarrassing to the administration in a way that making a concession in a brief or making a concession at oral argument in front of a district court would not be in, because you'd see the guy would be getting off the plane, then he'd go back home to Beltsville, and then the press would descend on him, and they'd interview him, and they'd interview his wife, and they'd interview his kids. How did it feel? What was the prison like? You know, first of all, it would be greatly politically embarrassing to this administration. That's point one. And point two is the whole object here is to get people out of the country and just not take responsibility for it, not take responsibility for making mistakes. They don't care if they make mistakes. So they want to set a precedent. I mean, this is, you know, again, this guy is from El Salvador. He's not one of the Venezuelans. It's a completely different case. But they want to set a precedent where they can do as little as possible to determine whether or not somebody should be deported. Okay, that's the front end. And on the back end, say, if they make a mistake, sorry, we're done. Can't do anything about it. Oops. And, you know, that's just it's just a recipe. It's a recipe for lawlessness. It's designed to be lawless, but it's also designed to create maximum fear, and it's designed to create maximum publicity for what the government is doing without creating publicity for the mistakes it's making. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense. And I just want to offer my expert analysis, which that sounds downright evil. Like, just you have sent somebody with no record. You admit it was a mistake and you won't get them back.
Yeah, no,
it's disgusting.
Here's what you have. I mean, you have a president who's a sociopath. I'm broken record, but he's a sociopath. He's surrounded by a lot of other sociopaths or people who are willing to accede to his sociopathy. They don't care about rules. They don't care about laws. They don't care about other human beings. What they care about is exercising power over other people. And, you know, they don't care.
This is like one of those things, though. I just have to say, like, a halfway decent person, if you knew that your screw up, there was a guy wasting away in an El Salvadorian prison because you made a mistake. Like, I don't know how somebody sleeps at night.
I would feel bad.
Yeah, I would feel bad.
I would feel bad. And so this is the kind of degeneracy that having a sociopathic, authoritarian, fascist leader creates in a society. You know, you've got these ICE agents wearing masks. Why are they wearing masks? They're not undercover CIA agents. They're wearing masks because they're ashamed of what they know what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. And then everybody.
And because they know there could be accountability down the road because
it's
wrong.
There could be accountability down the road because it's wrong. And they're also, you know, there's also this diffusion of responsibility that we've seen in other eras and other places. It's like, well, I'm just following orders.
Yeah.
I was told to do this. It wasn't my decision. It's above my pay grade. And, you know, that's how horrific things happen in a society and to a world.
Yeah. Speaking of you doing things to try to scare people, speaking of retribution and doing awful things, yesterday, on Wednesday, Trump issued a bunch of executive orders and presidential memoranda. And one was an executive order against the law firm Sussman Godfrey, the firm that represents the Dominion voting systems, including its $787 million settlement for lies about the 2020 election. And they also filed an amicus brief on behalf of former government officials in the Perkins Coie litigation. So what do you think? Is Sussman Godfrey going to fight this like Perkins and Wilmer and Jenner? Or
I think they will. You know, I don't know this firm the way I probably did 20 or 30 years ago. I remember interviewing at Steve Sussman's house in 1986 in Houston. He had this big house in River Oaks, the River Oaks neighborhood in Houston. And he was a really smart guy and a really, really hell of a trial lawyer. And he didn't take any shit from anybody. And this firm is sort of a hard-nosed firm, an honest, a good, skilled, really top-notch. They only have the best lawyers. They hire the best lawyers. And they pride themselves on taking tough positions and bringing tough cases and winning them. I think this, I don't think it's in their DNA to cave. And they don't have, I don't think they have a corporate practice at all. It's a pure litigation firm. So they don't have this problem that I've been describing, that these New York firms or these firms are trying to be like New York firms have, where they have these very, very lucrative transactional practices that require at some point government approval for the transactions to occur and then for them to get the paid huge fees that are percentages of the deal. So I don't think they will settle. I think they will fight. I think they are, I think they were probably the wrong target for Trump here. I don't know why they've chosen Sussman Godfrey, but I'm glad that they're choosing someone I think probably won't settle.
Yeah, well, it means I could be wrong.
I mean, sure. maybe the character of the firm has changed over the years. Maybe there are some compelling circumstances, but I think a pure litigation firm that does a lot of plaintiffs work is not going to be the type of firm that's going to cave to this administration.
Yeah, good. All right. So in addition to that EO yesterday, that executive order, Trump also issued two separate presidential memoranda against individuals who were former government employees. So one, and we know both of them, and we should just say that up front. One was Chris Krebs, the former head of CISA, which is the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency. So they oversaw like the implementation of the election in many ways, or the protection against like foreign actors, things like that. And the other one was Miles Taylor, who had worked for DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and in 2018 published an anonymous op-ed criticizing Trump. And then he authored a book about the chaos of Trump's first term, also anonymously. And then he came out right before the 2020 election and said, like, this is who I am. And I got a couple things about this. So this is, I was on TV. I was on doing Nicole like while this broke. And so I got asked about it. And I actually at the time didn't understand the difference between the presidential memoranda and the executive order. And so I was, my first instinct was like, what is he doing issuing? I mean, it's already insane enough. He's issuing executive orders against law firms, right? Executive orders are meant, these are policy things. And instead he's just using them. I mean, he said he would retributively, like to go after people. But now instead of just even going after institutions, he's going after individual people who he's pissed at because of how they acted in 2020. And we can take them separately, but like, it seems insane for Trump to be going after individuals like this.
It is absolutely insane. And it is pathetic. It is insane. And, you know, I mean, whether you call it a memorandum or an executive order.
Did you know the difference? Like, what is the difference?
I mean, I'm sure there's a technical difference, but at the end of the day, an executive order is a memorandum that goes out to agencies that gives them directions.
Just to be clear, he was telling the DOJ to go investigate them. Right. Like, that's the memoranda. Right. It's like, go investigate these guys.
You know, that is the most remarkable aspect of it. I mean, apart from the punitive and retributive aspect of it, the fact that he is telling the DOJ to investigate without any predication. Normally, when to start an investigation, under the DOJ manuals, under basic prosecutorial decency, prosecutorial professionalism, you need a predicate. You need some reason to believe that somebody committed a crime. These memoranda don't describe anything like that. It's their jokes. I mean, the case against the criticism of Krebs is that in the course of doing his job at CISA, he made a determination that the 2020 election was not the subject of widespread fraud, which every sane person, every non-delusional person agrees with.
With new McValue at McDonald's, you get more than you expect. So after a long day, buy a double cheeseburger and add a McChicken for a dollar. Because saving with deals is always on the menu. With new McValue.
Prices and participation may vary. Valid for item of equal or lesser value.
The Chris Krebs allegation, I mean, obviously it's all crazy, but like the Chris Krebs allegation is really, really scary and insane. And let me just read it to you. Okay. So this is what it says in the memoranda. The allegation was Krebs' misconduct involved the censorship of disfavored speech implicating the 2020 election and the COVID-19 pandemic. CISA covertly worked to blind the American public to the controversy surrounding Hunter Biden's laptop. Similarly, Krebs, through CISA, falsely and baselessly denied that the 2020 election was rigged and stolen, including by inappropriately and categorically dismissing widespread election malfeasance and serious vulnerabilities with voting machines. So this memoranda, okay, just let me break this down very simply. The memoranda is saying that the DOJ needs to investigate Chris Krebs because he said that the 2020 election was not rigged and stolen.
Right.
This is them saying, it's sort of like them dismissing the lawyer for having to admit the truth under oath in court, right? It's like, this guy said a true thing that we want people to believe is false, and therefore we're going to have the DOJ investigate it.
This is, you know, as you pointed out, this is authoritarianism.
This is
like, not only does the government just lie about everything, they lie about what happens in court, they lie to courts, they are punishing people for not lying. Or they're seeking to punish people for not lying. And they're trying to deter people from telling the truth. which is exactly what they're trying to do in the other case with Miles Taylor. All he did, he wrote a book. Okay. How many administration officials have written books? How many of them have written books that contain details that are not necessarily flattering to the president? You know, I can name
all
a whole
of them?
Bunch.
All of them,
except for I can think of one.
That's true.
I can think of one.
I meant that all presidents have these types of books written about them by insiders who are telling inside stories.
Right. I mean, you know, what's maybe Biden can get elected again and prosecute or can ask for the prosecution of Ron
like
Klein.
Ron Klein.
Klein for telling Whipple or whatever the guy's name is that he wasn't all there before the debate. I mean, you know, where does this stop? It's brazenly unconstitutional. And, you know, there's no predicate here for any criminal action. There's no allegation that any of this stuff, for example, was classified.
Well, he says, I mean, it's in the allegation. Let me read this Taylor allegation.
Yeah.
While serving as an administrative staff assistant at the Department of Homeland Security, Taylor stoked dissension by manufacturing sensationalist reports on the existence of a supposed resistance within the federal government that vowed to undermine and render ineffective a sitting president. He illegally published classified conversations to sell his book under the pseudonym Anonymous, which is full of falsehoods and fabricated stories. Where a government employee improperly discloses sensitive information for the purpose of personal enrichment and undermining our foreign policy, national security, and government effectiveness, all ultimately designed to sow chaos and distrust in government, this conduct could properly be characterized as treasonous and as possibly violating the Espionage Act.
Yeah, I mean, that's gibberish. I mean, either the information, they're basically saying he spread false information, but the false information was classified. But of course, they don't actually specify the nature of the classification. Maybe Donald Trump, now that he's been reinstated as president, he reclassified everything retroactively.
You're
that's
onto
it.
Something there, George.
Yeah, no. And the notion that Donald Trump is invoking the Espionage Act when he actually stole classified documents in violation of an act that plainly says that if you take documents from the government and you're asked to return them and you do not return them and you refuse to, and he, you know, in addition refusing, he lied about them. I mean, you know, maybe he thinks he's now an expert on the Espionage Act, but he hasn't actually stated any fact, even anything remotely suggestive of a fact that suggests that Miles Taylor violated any law, let alone the Espionage Act. It's just absurd. It's just an embarrassment.
Treasonous is like, those are big boy words. Those are big boy allegations. Treason.
He loves, basically his view of treason is I'm president. Anything you do to criticize me is treason, which that's not the historical definition of treason. That's the historical definition of free speech.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And I got to say, like, besides the fact that he's going after people who criticized him and who one of them literally just told the truth about the election not being stolen, there's also the element here, though, of we're talking earlier about the chilling effect that so many of these things had, but it's also sending a message, right, to anybody in his administration. So one thing that I'm sure people understand this, but just to say it explicitly, one of the tools that people in Trump's administrations have had to curbing his worst impulses is by leaking information to reporters who then tell people about it that makes everybody go, oh, no, he shouldn't do that. And let me tell you why, and sort of puts people in motion to try and talk him out of his worst ideas. Right. And so leaking inside the Trump administration is legion. People are always leaking there as like a mechanism for trying to control him or, you know, curb him.
Well, that was really the first administration. It's less now because he's doing things like this. Well,
too,
also
right?
because
well, it's all sycophants now.
Yeah, they're all sycophants now, and they all want to curry favor with them. And the way, you know, I guess now the most common method to try to persuade him of something is to go on TV and say, "Oh, the president is brilliant. That's why he's going to do X." You know, I mean, it's it's just the level of stupid is just tremendous. But you're absolutely right. The carrot is that you're not going to get ahead in this administration unless you anticipate the president's needs and tell him and flatter him, tell him to his face what a genius he is and tell the world what a genius he is, even though you said he was a genius from doing X yesterday at 3 o'clock today, he does not X. And you say, oh, what a genius move. He did exactly the opposite of what he said yesterday. It was brilliant. He fooled everybody. He's so smarter. He's playing 55-dimensional chess. And, you know, it's absurd. It is just, we live in a country where you have an administration that is just founded on lies, illogic, and sycophancy, and cruelty. That's where we are.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, can I ask you just a technical question? Because, like, I'm obviously, you know, you worry about what's going to happen to these guys who are now being targeted like this. What does happen when the DOJ investigates you for, I don't know, telling the truth about the election not being stolen? What kind of stuff do they do?
I don't know, because, you know, we don't know what the allegations are. We don't know what the alleged crimes are. I mean, if they're trying to figure out what he knew.
He falsely and baselessly denied that the 2020 election was rigged and stolen.
Go to Amazon and buy the book. How are they going to prove that? What are they going to prove? What do you do? You going to relitigate the 2020 election? How do you investigate that? You know, the only thing I could say would be if, you know, they had some semblance of an issue that there was classified information somewhere. Or if they could find some, I don't know, financial impropriety somehow, but they got to have a basis to make that inquiry. No, but, you know, that being said, you know, nobody likes to be investigated. Nobody, I wouldn't want to be investigated, but what are they investigating? You can't even figure it out. This lands on your desk. Right. Let's say you're a prosecutor at DOJ. This lands on your desk and you're the one they put in charge of investigating Miles Taylor. What do you do? What questions do you ask? Who do you
interview?
I guess
you're right. You read the book and you have to try to determine that something must have been classified. Also,
I
let's
guess
just quickly
that would
note,
be,
can you believe that this administration really cares about classified information? Like the least careful with classified documents of any administration in history.
And what makes it doubly absurd is that this book came out years ago. He came out and admitted publicly, well, you know, in 2020, they didn't do an investigation then. I mean,
That's true. He was still president when it happened.
Correct. He was president when the first op-ed, the first anonymous op-ed came out.
But I mean, even when Miles said, like, it's me,
it's
I'm anonymous.
Me, yeah, after he left Homeland Security, yeah. It's crazy. It's loopy.
Yeah, this is...
No, I mean, these are just really designed to spin up people on Fox News. I said false news, faux news. I don't know how this gets converted into action.
Yeah.
Maybe they can invent something. Maybe they're cleverer than I suspect, but I just think they just do these things just almost randomly now.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting how, you know, you always think about Trump.
One thing. They did revoke the security clearances of everybody at the University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, good.
Did you see that, right? I think in the Miles Taylor one, they said
they revoked his security clearance.
And then they said
this guy
I think,
didn't,
they said
he didn't still
about,
have clearance.
What? He's not getting any classified information. Neither is him.
These people are just. If they weren't so stupid, they'd be very scary.
Well, they are. You know, look, they're both unbelievably stupid. Most of them, and Trump is head stupid, but also unbelievably malevolent.
Right.
And there are a few of them who are actually smart and malevolent, and that Trump listens to, like Stephen Miller.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, and then there are just people who are just loopy and malevolent, like Navarro, who, by the way, is still trying to get his conviction overturned. I read the other day. I'm surprised the Justice Department hasn't tried to figure out a way to help him.
Yeah. But. Well, okay. George Conway, as always, thanks for explaining the illegal news to me. And thanks to all of you for listening to another episode and hanging out with us. Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave us a review, and we will see you guys next week.
Yep.
Bye. Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last.